This podcast is produced by Secure World Foundation, an endowed private operating foundation that promotes cooperative solutions for space sustainability and the peaceful uses of outer space. The podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. For more information, please visit swfound.org.
Hi everyone, thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to see everyone here, particularly since some of you may have had issues with the registration form, and so it's a surprise to have you here, but we're very pleased to have you here nonetheless. My name is Victoria Sampson. I'm the Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation, a private operating foundation that focuses on cooperative solutions for space sustainability. A common perception is that China's increasing investments in space and its increasing reliance on space results in a zero-sum game for U.S. national security. That is to say, the more that China spends in space, the less secure the United States is. There's another way to perceive that. You could also argue that the more money China spends on space and the more reliant they become on their space assets, the more of an investment they have in space, and therefore the more likely they are to be looking for an international cooperative space governance. We'll see. So today we have a panel of experts to discuss this issue, specifically looking at China's ISR capabilities. We have, starting from our right, Mark Stokes, the Executive Director of the Project 2049 Institute, Kevin Pulpeather, the China Project Manager for the Center for Intelligence Research and Analysis of Defense Group, Inc. Then we have our own Brian Whedon, Secure World's Technical Advisor. Finally, we have Owen Cote, the Associate Director of the Space Studies Program at MIT. We'll be having these experts discuss China's ISR capabilities and what it means for the future of security in the region, and we'll be followed by a Q&A. And as well, we'll be having food at this event. The food should be arriving fairly shortly. Feel free to go back and graze at any point, whether you want to do it while people are talking or during the Q&A if there, or knock yourself out after the event as well. We'll have coffee, soda as well, in just a few minutes. So with that, let's turn on to, I believe Kevin will be starting up.
Okay. Okay, I'd like to thank the Secure World Foundation and Victoria and Brian for inviting me here. So I look forward to it. I look forward to a good Q&A after the talks are done. I've been asked to talk about China's military space doctrine / strategy. So what I'm going to do is give an overview of some pertinent ideas, points on China's overall military strategy, and then relate those to China's military space strategy, or at least how they're writing about it. It's, what their actual space strategy may be is a little bit opaque at this point, but we can learn a little bit at least from what they're writing about it. So I'd first like to start off with China's military strategy, which is called an active defense strategy, which China says is purely defensive. Now, why do they call it an active defense strategy? Active defense means that they will not be the first to attack, but if they are, they will defend themselves vigorously. They are not anticipating, a 1991 Iraq Gulf War, Iraq strategy where they dig trenches and they just take the punches. No, they want to go on the offensive immediately. However, the important thing you need to remember about the active defense strategy is that it's best characterized as politically defensive but operationally offensive. And what I mean by this is that there's a political cover where China will say that they will not be the first to attack. However, when you start scratching the surface of that statement and you start look at Chinese writings on, well, when will they attack? What do they really mean by that? You start seeing discussions of what actually constitutes a first strike? What constitutes a beginning of an attack? Would deployment sufficient deployment of an enemy in or potential enemy into a battlefield area, would that constitute a so-called strategic first strike? So you see that in a lot of Chinese writings that it's not actually what they constitute a first strike is not actually any shooting of weapons, any firing. It's actually just maybe deployments or actions which they can be deemed more offensive. Now, when you take a look at this, that you also see that Chinese write a lot about a concept called gaining mastery by striking first, Shenfa Juren. And this has three main points. It can be preemption. It can be surprise attacks. Or, as we used to say in the Marine Corps, you know, using the natural aggressiveness of the United States Marine, you know, where you're just, you know, constantly, you know, going on the attack. And you see that, and this is tied, gaining mastery by striking first is tied very closely to the way Chinese see modern wars being fought. If you set aside the Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, where we, got caught in a counterinsurgency campaign. If you take a look like the Falklands War, operations over Serbia, Yugoslavia, if you look at the 1991 Gulf War, you'll see that modern wars are finished very quickly, usually in just one campaign. You know, World War II, you know, we had the North Africa campaign, took over North Africa, went to Italy, had the Italy campaign, and then we went to the Northern European campaign, and then we finished up World War II in Europe. Not so with modern wars. They're usually very violent and very quick. And so you need to be able to start off to a quick start and cause a lot of damage up front. Furthermore, if you wait for an adversary, let's say like the United States, to get locked and loaded on your border, it's probably too late. Okay? Because the U.S. military will probably just steamroll over anybody who lets us get prepared. So what you see is a lot of writings on, you know, gaining mastery by striking first, maybe even during a deployment stage. And so what the Chinese say is that you need to gain the initiative at the outset of a conflict. Okay? Do not wait for the enemy to strike. Go ahead and strike first. Seize that initiative so you can take the fight to the enemy. When they talk about seizing the initiative, you know, they're not talking anymore about wars of annihilation. You know, they're not talking like a Korean War or their Vietnam War type of battle where it's just massive attrition, human wave attacks, that sort of thing. What they're now talking about is conducting targeted strikes against what they call vital targets. Now, what are vital targets? Vital targets are targets that, if destroyed or incapacitated, could cause a cascade effect on the rest of the battle, which will then lead to victory. So they're looking for maybe a target or a target set which can help them establish, you know, a decisive victory from the outset. And this is especially important, let me quote here, where the PLA faces a powerful enemy equipped with high technology weapons and equipment. Now, what are those vital targets? The Chinese are now focusing a lot on information warfare. Okay, so they're taking a look at targets that are involved in the collecting and processing of information. Information superiority is now seen as the main determiner of success on the battlefield. Again, not talking wars of annihilation anymore. We're talking about, you know, how does China go out and hit the other side's C4ISR assets? You know, command and control, communication nodes, reconnaissance nodes, that sort of thing. However, China also knows its own strengths. It knows that it's not the U.S. military. It can't just go out and attack everything all at once like we like to do. So what you see in Chinese writings is that they talk about achieving information control over a specified time and location. So they're not looking at seizing information control from the very outset and continuing it through to the entire campaign. If they could do that, they would very much, you know, want to do that. But they know their strengths, but what they want to do is they want to go in, hit a vital target, open up that window of opportunity, strike perhaps a decisive blow, and then get out before the enemy has a chance to recover. That's all they're looking for. But it's, you know, considering their strengths and the types of weapons that they're investing in, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Now, when we're talking about information warfare, you know, we have various different things that belong to information warfare: electronic warfare, cyber attacks, psychological warfare. But of course, one subset of information warfare is space warfare. What is space warfare according to Chinese writings? It's defined differently by just about everybody that you read, but there are some basic tenets that, you know, there's so some common themes. One is that it's military offensive and defensive operations in outer space. Okay, these include attacks against targets in the air, ground, sea, or space from space, attacks against targets in space from the air, ground, sea, or space, and attacks against ground segments. Interestingly, the Chinese, many Chinese writers, not all, but many, classify ISR assets, communication satellites, meteorological satellites, as space weapons. You know, things that we probably wouldn't normally classify as a weapon. You know, taking into this context of achieving information control, and that space warfare is a subset of information warfare, you know, where does space play a role in this battle? And granted, you know, these are the you know, so-called Chinese space cadets who are writing, so they are going to you know, emphasize the importance of space over other types of operations. But what you see in Chinese writings on space warfare is that whoever controls space will control the Earth. Common theme. It's almost like it's obligatory. You know, if you're writing an article or a book, then you have to put that in. And this is based on space being the new high ground. China is looking at the way the U.S. military has conducted its operations and has seen the benefits that space provide to the U.S. military. And so, you know, they make assessments that 70 to 80% of U.S. intelligence collection is done through space. They assess that U.S. relies on space for 80% of its communications. And also, you just get a general feeling when you're reading Chinese writings that there's sort of this mythical capability given to U.S. space-based ISR, and that, you know, if they're out driving a truck somewhere, you know, out in the hinterlands, you know, we know that they're driving that truck. You know, it's sort of like enemy of the state sort of situation, you know. Too old? Am I dating myself? No. I made a Wrath of Khan reference once, and nobody got it. I was just like, really? Am I that old? So they really see space as the primary, I wouldn't say the primary field, but the most important domain. Because if you do not have control of space, then you will not be able to control the rest of the other domains. And without space, conducting modern war is not possible. And so what the Chinese write because of this is that space will become a battlefield. And what you'll see is you will see an evolution of space warfare, much like you have seen the evolution of air warfare. You know, World War I, you know, you had the biplanes flying over the battlefield. Maybe they were taking some pictures, and then somebody got the bright idea to take a revolver up in there, and they started shooting at each other. And then they got they started putting machine guns on planes. And then, you know, by World War II, we had strategic bombers, you know, that sort of thing. And now we have, you know, and now we have B-2s. They see the same sort of evolution of space warfare. Right now, we are in that beginning stage. We are back in World War I, where the biplanes are flying over the trenches taking pictures. Okay, you know, maybe we have a pistol. Maybe, okay? But that's where they see it. But they see it progressing towards the era of dogfights and space-based assets attacking targets on the ground. And because of this, because space will be contested, achieving control of space will become the first priority of any campaign. So what you see is that, you know, hey, at the very outset, let's start taking down some satellites. Now, if I can switch gears here a little bit, talk a little bit about more of the offensive, shooting to kill side, but there is also a force enhancement side to Chinese writings on space. And what I mean by this is, you know, how do they use these space-based ISR assets to conduct the information warfare, to seize the initiative? And here, again, you see that Chinese writings are heavily influenced by U.S. writings on network-centric warfare. This term was invented by Admiral Sobrowski back in 1997. I can't find really a definition of it. I find descriptions of it. I don't never find a definition. But what it is it's connecting all of your forces together via networks, via computer networks, communication networks, and that this will provide a common battlefield picture to everybody on your side. So everybody from the lowliest prive all the way up to the four-star general will have access to a common battlefield picture. And that this is intended to speed up reaction time of your own forces. Because if that prive can see the enemy coming through the pass, he doesn't need to call his lieutenant and say, hey, can I do this? He is supposed to take the initiative and go out and take his troops and stop that enemy from coming through the pass. So what we see is an emphasis on interconnectedness, of linking up your communications from different forces, okay, multiple services, making it a truly joint campaign, and linking those through computer communication networks, and then fusing the information that you receive from your ISR assets, fusing that, and then pushing the information out to the troops in the field. And of course, this is intended to improve attacks, you know, against, let's say, Taiwan. You could also imagine, though they don't get specific in their writings, you could assume that when they're talking about this type of architecture, it could be used in an anti-ship ballistic missile context or a long-range anti-ship cruise missile context. On the counter space side, of course, whereas the force enhancement side is designed to improve China's ability to conduct operations, to improve what they call what we call an OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, act, to speed up that OODA loop, they also write actually more about how to attack the other side's space assets to slow down their OODA loop. Okay. And in this context, space is viewed as a great U.S. strength. It's also viewed as a great U.S. vulnerability. It is frequently written that attacks against components of the U.S. space architecture can debilitate the U.S.'s entire information system. So by taking out the U.S.'s space assets, you can pretty much stop us militarily. But again, they're looking to create a window of opportunity. They're not looking to seize control for long periods of time. They're looking to go in, take out some assets for a short period of time, conduct the attack, and then get out. This is sort of a down and dirty look at China's doctrine and then how it pertains to space warfare, space-based ISR. But when you read these Chinese writings, you get the idea, and it comes through loud and clear that China is not Iraq. Okay, they're not going to sit by and let things happen. They are developing a wide array of satellites, which Mark will talk to here in a few minutes. And this is definitely a culture that is thinking about how do we both develop these weapon systems and how do we use them. It also comes through clear, at least in Chinese writings, that China wants to use space and deny it to others. And of course, this has implications, anti-access aerial denial implications. However, what you don't see being written in Chinese writings on space warfare is, as China becomes a much stronger space power, as their military becomes more dependent on space, they inherit the same vulnerabilities that we inherit. They don't mention that. There are some writings on information warfare in general that do acknowledge that, but they say, we have to go through this phase where we may be very vulnerable, but we got to get through that phase, okay? And get to a place where we can use our information infrastructure, but do it securely. How you do that in space, still remains an open question. So, this I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more later on, but it does open up vulnerabilities for China, and they don't seem to be addressing that. So with that, I will hand it off to the next.
Okay, first, I'd like to express my appreciation for an opportunity to discuss one of my favorite topics. What I'll do is, Kevin's done a good job about addressing the broader, sort of the bigger picture issues in terms of doctrine and general requirements. So what I'd like to do is use my time to take it down into the weeds, deep into the weeds to a certain extent, by addressing three issues. One is addressing a bit more the issue of operational requirements and looking with a little bit more specificity. And then getting in a bit to organizational issues, both on the requirements development side, as well as the research and development and industrial side, and then wrap it up with some detail on programmatics in terms of specific capabilities that China appears to be focused on. Starting off with at least some of the operational requirement side. One of our focus areas here is on intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, the ISR side. And what I tend to focus on mostly is their long-range precision strike and the role that space-based ISR could play in supporting a long-range precision strike capability. For example, looking at an anti-ship ballistic missile, or ASBM for short. So a key part, it's good to have situational awareness of things that are going on a global basis and around the world. And that doesn't necessarily imply that if China's developing a space reconnaissance architecture that they have global aspirations. But from my perspective, on the long-range precision strike side, the requirement exists to be able to maintain what I consider a somewhat persistent surveillance of the area within range of their long-range precision strike assets. For example, an ASBM motion lead would be, let's say, 2,000 kilometers, roughly, what I would consider to be viable indications of being able to extend that strike range out to, say, 3,000 kilometers, notional kind of Guam, for example. But the key thing is to be able to have some degree of persistent surveillance, or at least sufficient to be able to provide queuing data to a long-range precision strike asset like an anti-ship ballistic missile. And what this would require, of course, would be a whole range of sensors, not just space-based sensors. And let me take just a second. I've always been curious about what is space exactly. And I don't think there actually is a definition of what, at least an internationally legal definition of where space is. I guess there's an international equivalent of the FAA that at least one notionally defines space as beginning at about 100 kilometers. With space being that domain above 100 kilometers, and one could also look at an intermediate domain, which could be called near space, between, let's say, 20 kilometers and 100 kilometers, and then the area below that being air. Now, there's air, basically where air breathing platforms would operate. But so the idea is to be able to have persistent surveillance, of which space-based assets or satellites would be one component. I've also been focused on near space flight vehicles, which would be flight vehicles that would operate within that 20 to 100 kilometer realm. U.S. Air Force, I'm a retired U.S. Air Force officer, so I have somewhat of a bias on sort of air and space perspectives. But U.S. Air Force had a whole series of writings about 2005 timeframe on the idea of high-altitude airships. And it's kind of seems to have gone by the wayside, at least in the U.S., but China has grasped this concept of near-space flight vehicles with a passion. Because for persistent surveillance, it gives you some of the attributes or some of the benefits that one would have from satellites in orbit, but of course some other benefits of that persistence, being able to stay in an area, having, for example, low observability, having an airship, as well as sort of slow moving to be able to maintain position in a particular area. But in terms of the satellite side, they would also need, assume, let's say, for example, in a general war, thinking sort of the doomsday scenario or the Dr. Strangelove thing in a full war scenario, that they probably would lose their static launch infrastructure, you know, that they have three launch sites, so probably lose that. And so therefore, operationally responsive space capabilities or launch on demand, in other words, being able to launch a small microsatellite into orbit on a very quick notice would be a requirement as well. But another aspect of space, of course, is being able to surveil and track other countries' assets in space, whether for space flight vehicles, whether they be satellites or whether they be ballistic missiles or anything that would travel within that domain of space. And a key requirement for this is would be space surveillance. In other words, in order to be able to engage something, it seems like you'd have to be able to see it. And being able to see low observable targets in space, like U.S. satellites, low observable U.S. satellites that could be intentionally minimized in terms of radar cross-section, would be a requirement. And I'll get to some of the organizational issues. They've had a long space tracking capability, but these seem to be for cooperative targets. And a key area of research, at least that I've been interested in, would be how they surveil and track non-cooperative targets with very low radar cross-section. And then, of course, being able to have the ability to intercept objects in space, in which they've proven some capability at least twice, back in 2007 and then again in 2010. But that's just sort of an idea of operational requirements, what they would need. Looking at who actually developed some of the requirements, the key organization that, from my perspective, that is responsible for developing the operational requirements would be the warfighters. And, of course, people would normally think of the warfighters as being the Navy, for example, or the Air Force, or the 2nd Artillery, their strategic rocket force. But it seems that on the space side, most of the operational requirements would be developed by their equivalent of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or their General Staff Department. And within the General Staff Department, that's like a first-level department, and then there are second-level departments under the General Staff Department. For example, the first department, their operations, their equivalent of a J-3. These guys, under their J-3 equivalent, they would have organizations like responsible for surveillance or survey and mapping. Why is survey and mapping important? Well, that's the BeiDou system, the navigation satellite system. The PLA, my impression is that the PLA, General Staff Department, actually manages the ground component, that is taking that data from navigation satellites and turning it into operationally useful information for users around the country. And they maintain an infrastructure for the data received from navigation satellites. Weather, for example, under their operations department, it's an operational support function. The second department, beyond the first department, which is operations, second department is their general, like, DIA equivalent, roughly. A key organization underneath their DIA equivalent is the Aerospace Bureau. The Space Bureau. Space Reconnaissance Bureau are the ones that would develop the operational requirements and also operate ground stations for their reconnaissance, for example, electro-optical satellites, as well as their synthetic aperture radar satellites. So that's a key organization. They also oversee, by the way, a relatively recently established unmanned aerial vehicle strategic UAV unit just north of Beijing. Another very important department, second-level department, would be their third department, their equivalent to National Security Agency, NSA. Third department is their primarily, just like NSA, responsible for communications intelligence or comment. And, of course, that would then lead to a requirement for having a space-based communications intelligence ability. And there appears to be some movement in this area, a comment package on a satellite piggybacked upon a weather satellite. Haven't delved into this much detail yet, but it's interesting. And then, of course, they have the fourth department, which is dedicated to radar and electronic intelligence, or ELINT. And of course, ELIN is a very a former Air Force SIGINT guy, somewhat biased on the importance of signals intelligence. ELIN is one of the most important sensors that one could have in terms of persistent surveillance. They appear to have at least a basic architecture up for collecting electronic intelligence signals, as well as jamming, ground-based jammers, for example, going after U.S. GPS or synthetic reconnaissance assets. But this is like on the operational requirements side. On the technical requirements development, key organization equivalent to General Staff Department is what's called General Armaments Department. This would be roughly equivalent to our OSD Acquisition Technology Logistics, or OSD-ATNL. These are the ones that would take those operational requirements and bring them down to a level of detail in which they could task or contract with design and R&D organizations within their industry. Their space bureau under the General Armaments Department is subordinate to an organization that is responsible for information infrastructure. When the Chinese talk about informatization or whatever that term they tend to use, space is considered to be a critical aspect of this overall emphasis on information dominance that Kevin referred to. This organization, the Space Bureau, Space Equipment Bureau, under their Information Infrastructure Department, is a critical organization and probably the ones that would task contract with the defense industry. On the defense industry side, they're equivalent to a Lockheed Martin or a Boeing. They have two main corporate entities, enterprises, large enterprises that have, let's say, roughly 100,000, 120,000 personnel. So large corporate enterprises that are broken down into what's called academies, based in part upon the Russian model. The academies, there's, for example, on the two corporations, the only difference in the names for these things is the word technology and industry. One of them is called China Aerospace Science Technology Corporation. The other one is Science and Industry Corporation, or CASC and CASIC for short. Within these two corporate enterprises, academies, in the center of each academy is a design bureau. And they're fairly well structured for designing, developing, and then producing space-based assets with sort of well-established lanes with some degree of competition, but more well-established. For example, the key organization for designing electro-optical satellites would be under CASC, called the Fifth Academy, China Academy of Space Technology, and a different organization underneath that same corporate structure responsible for synthetic aperture radar and ELIN satellites would be down in Shanghai, sort of a space cluster, a space design and development cluster and production cluster down in Shanghai. And then different organizations for launch vehicles. So this just gives a general sort of concept of the organization that's there. An organization, of course, is important in terms of looking at technology innovation and ability to leverage resources that exist within the country. In terms of looking at specifics on programs, going in a little bit deeper on the ISR side, you could look at the ISR as having five different sort of aspects of ISR, including basically taking pictures of objects from space, electro-optical. There appears to be a requirement to go down to about, in terms of spatial resolution, about maybe 0.25 meters, which is not necessarily, I assume the U.S., I don't know what our state-of-the-art is, but it's not bad. I'm not sure if China is quite there yet, but that appears to be sort of a target that they want to be able to get to significantly sub-meter resolution. Another area of emphasis is on synthetic aperture, but the issue is electro-optical, of course, is that it only is daylight only, and being able to image only in good weather without cloud cover. To be able to make up for some of these shortcomings on the electro-optical side, synthetic aperture radar is critical, which is able to sort of use of radar in space to be able to image objects on the surface. 24-hour day and then all weather. And they have a fairly well-established base for their synthetic aperture radar satellite, starting off on the commercial, mostly from the commercial requirement side, but gradually appearing to have dedicated military SAR satellites that have been launched in the last 3 or 4 years, and a growing architecture at that. And this would be linked to the third aspect of ISR, which would be the ELINT satellite program. that has a long history of some experimental ELAN satellites, but electronic intelligence is critical for example, if you want to track ship movements at sea, for example, Aegis Battery, focused on electronic emitters. One of the best ways to do it, of course, is simply tracking the electronic emitters. Ships have to either communicate or emit a signal, for example, the radars. And having assets in space to be able to track and identify, be able to look at the signature of a ship based upon its electronic signature is a key way to be able to geolocate objects or things that are moving at sea. And it appears that they have at least some initial capabilities in this area. Communications intelligence, another side of it, as mentioned before, it appears to be some initial at least experimental packages in orbit today. Something also been looking at is, of course, infrared. We have an old defense support program satellite to be able to detect the heat generated by ballistic missiles shortly upon launch. And no smoking gun on this one yet, but there appears to be significant interest in fielding a missile, ballistic missile early warning capability. That has implications, of course, for nuclear doctrine. One shouldn't make the leap automatically towards sort of a launch on warning a shift that could be driven by new technological breakthroughs, but it's something to be able to look at. In terms of other things, in terms of operational capabilities or programs on this on the launch infrastructure, a key indicator would it makes sense if they want to have an operational responsive capability, be able to get satellites up in space. They want to move toward a solid fuel launch vehicle capability. Right now, their launch vehicles, of course, their family of launch vehicles are liquid fueled, and there does appear to be a significant interest, if not even at least experimental systems, launch solid fuel launch vehicles for the Kytorger KT series. One of the problems, though, in looking at the KT solid fuel launch vehicles based on the DF-21 ballistic missile variant, is that it doesn't look like there's a dedicated military organization or operational unit that has integrated these KT solid launch vehicles. However, it still needs to be looked at in some detail. If it's going to be in terms of solid fuel launch vehicles, it makes some sense for them to be sort of an additional add-on capability given to their ballistic missile forces. But something that needs to be watched a little bit more. And one final aspect of the space, of course, is denying potential adversaries the use of space, and this gets into that scales underneath that first department that I mentioned before, like the J3 equivalent, they appear to there's a new what's called space debris surveillance organization that's established in Nanjing. And the space debris, of course, could sincere some concern over space debris, but of course, space debris being able to track objects, for example, that are about 5 centimeters in size of maybe a grapefruit, and apply some of them to be able to surveil and track satellites or objects in space as well. But with that, I'll wrap it up and turn it back over to you.
Hi, I'm Owen Cote, and I'm from the MIT Security Studies Program, not the Space Studies Program. I know that... Space on the brain, that's right. Thanks for inviting me, and I'm going to come at this more from the technology side rather than, say, from the China side or from the U.S. side. And I've been asked to talk particularly about the role of space in the Chinese, as the terminology now says, the A2AD capability, the anti-access area denial, or what we used to call sea denial back in the Cold War days. So what is the role of space in that mission? And I'm going to expand my grit a little bit to talk about the role of space, if any, in our response to that problem. And I'm also going to take up the sort of comments that Victoria made at the beginning about what some of this will mean for, I don't know what the right word is, but sort of say stability in space or a space environment that is less focused on things like ASATs and stuff like that. So the first thing I'm going to do is talk about this this question of a Chinese A2AD capability, a capability that for our purposes we can say is designed to keep American, well, it's designed to convince people in the region that American aircraft carriers will be reticent about operating in the areas they have to operate in if they're going to protect those people were they to get into it with China. And the reason why I say it that way is that obviously this is about perceptions, and in that sense they've already achieved their objective on some level. And the degree to which perceptions matter compared to the technological background, this is a really dramatic case of, you know, I think that the perceptions are pretty far ahead, at least right now, of what the reality is. But if you were going to make that more of a reality, and let's focus on this anti-ship ballistic missile that Mark talked about. That's not the only thing that's part of this new A2AD capability, but it's the newest in the sense of they're the first people that have really tried to do this. Obviously, submarines are a part of this package of A2AD. They've much less invested in traditional land-based aviation like the Soviets did, but they have a little of that. But let's focus on the anti-ship ballistic missile capability, because I think that will be the one that will probably drive Chinese activities in space more than the other areas, and it's also the most challenging mission. So as Mark said, China's heavily invested in imagery satellites of both types, this initially EO like we did, and now SAR. Now, I would point out that it's important when we talk about space to be specific when we're getting this specific about missions, to be specific about what part of space. So let me talk just for a second about just some broad categories to think about when you're talking about space. There's low Earth orbit, and then there's everything else as far as I'm concerned, or geosynchronous orbit, medium Earth orbit. Low Earth orbit is fundamentally different from the other orbits. And low Earth orbit is where we'll be talking about when we talk about China and A2AD, right? The basic idea in ocean surveillance, which is what you're talking about if you're trying to deal with aircraft carriers, is that you're trying to find moving targets in the ocean surveillance case against a relatively uncluttered background compared to the land. But the targets are moving, and it's over a very broad area, and there are no roads, and there are no whatevers to canalize movement. So there's complete freedom of movement over the surface that you're interested in. And so imagery satellites, whether they're electro-optical or SAR, are not very useful for finding ships. You can use them to go take a look at a ship that you've already discovered, but they're not very useful for finding ships. And the fundamental reason is because, you all know, most of these satellites are designed to create pretty high-resolution images. To do that, they have to do what any camera has to do, which is to focus. And if you focus, you narrow your field of view. The whole point about getting up into low Earth orbit is to expand your field of view. And so what happens is that, you know, if you're in low Earth orbit and you do a pass over an area and you're an EO satellite, you have to be told where to look. Very specifically within that area to take the picture you want to take, and you can't see anything else. So that's not very good if you're trying to find something in that area and there's no clues to where it is. And so that's why in every case where people have wanted to solve this problem, they've had to basically, it used to be eyeballs in airplanes, but I mean, if you want to solve the problem on an ocean-wide basis, you have to go to radars. You have to go to the kind of radars that can search wide areas. They're not imaging radars. And you have to get altitude, and the best way to do it is from the air. It's from an airborne platform, and that's how we do it. You lose a little bit of field of view because you're lower than low Earth orbit, but you're much more powerful. The radar is much more powerful. You can move at a reasonable rate, but you can be persistent if you want to. If you're in low Earth orbit, you know, the laws of physics tell you how often you can come back and look at the same place. If you're in an airplane, you can decide to hang out. If you want to search the Philippine Sea, the best way to do that is with five airplanes and P-3s, Global Hawks down the road. That's the best way to do it by far. Now, China's made a decision in their posture at sea that this is not the route they're going to take. They're not even in contest control of the air over the sea, right? This aircraft carrier that's coming along is not even close to beginning that process. So they've understandably made the decision to go into low Earth orbit to try to do this, which is exactly what the Soviets did in the Cold War. So if, for those of you who have a memory of it, the Soviets did two things, one of which the Chinese apparently have already started to do, which is that they deployed E-Link satellites in low Earth orbit that would pick up on radars on ships as long as they were emitting. And then it also developed a radar satellite called Warsat that would take a, would be basically a blob detector looking at the horizon along the water and detect the profile of the ship, and could therefore detect roughly the length of the ship unless it was bow on, and unless the seas were really rough, so you can start to see some of the problems. And these two would operate in tandem. The radar satellite allows you to detect a non-cooperative target. The EORSAT hopefully allows you to identify that target. It also gives you ability to reduce the area of uncertainty of it, but it doesn't really give you great targeting information if it was a lone satellite. The Chinese have developed this triplet, we think. They're starting to do that we did when we got into this business, and that gives you a little bit better location, but it also gives you the ability to locate multiple ships in one pass, which is really what that capability provides. But the point is that we've had a little experience with this approach to ocean surveillance. I'm not going to get into too much, and we can certainly do in the Q&A about how successful the Soviets were and how we dealt with this problem, but I will say that it looks like the Chinese are going down this path. And that would mean that the next step would be for them to try and develop a radar satellite, which I don't know if there's any evidence of that. That's a lot harder than what they've done so far, but you could see that coming down the road. So I do see a deepening investment in low Earth orbit for this purpose coming to coming down the road from China. But I want to emphasize that the part that is relevant to the tough part of the problem is not all the imagery stuff that they've already developed, which I think is designed to look at airfields and things like that and see, oh, are there C-17s there? Are there V-2s there? Are there whatever there? That kind of thing. Because you know where the airfields are. So, you know, it's not a problem to tell the imager where to look. Now, this might imply, as Victoria was saying, that, you know, the more you invest in this medium, you know, the more you have to lose if you decide to attack the other guy's stuff that's in that, that's operating in that medium. That's just obvious, right? And so there's very good reason to believe that this may actually happen on the Chinese side, that in some sense this great investment that it seems like they're preparing to make, and to some extent which they've already started to make, could indicate that they would become more wary about certainly starting you know, a kind of struggle for control of low Earth orbit using ASATs and stuff like that. My second point, though, is to not get too excited yet. because I think there's another part of the story, which is that if you look at the U.S. military, and particularly if you look at the U.S. Navy, I think you'd be shocked to discover how little we depend on low Earth orbit for our military stuff, our naval stuff. Okay, I already told you before about this historic investment we have that we're only going to expand dramatically in persistent airborne surveillance, right? That we're going to buy something like 40, they're Global Hawks, but the Navy calls them BAMPs. And, you know, we are going to, that is how we are going to develop our picture of the surface. Low Earth orbit has pretty much nothing to do with ASW, and ASW is probably, you know, the main thing that we worry about, at least in the near term, when we talk about A2AD. Low Earth orbit isn't going to have much to do with, you know, countering an ASBM. I mean, we're going to detect the ASBM with IR satellites, but they're geo. What low Earth orbit has done for us is, correctly, is Mark was saying about what the Chinese believe, it's a peacetime intelligence thing as much as anything. And if you look at the way the satellites are designed, they're designed to measure things very precisely so that you can monitor things like salt treatments and stuff like that. That era, right? We had to measure the diameter of the silo to inches, and we had to make sure that they weren't cheating by building bigger missiles and so on and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of tactical utility just in imagery that's like a meter or two. And commercial space may actually start providing tactically relevant imagery like that to the floor. But mostly what we get, for example, the War on Terror, we're getting all that from persistent airborne surveillance. Now, some of that's going to drop out in the context of the stuff in China. I would argue that the middle tier that's dominant now, that the predator types, that's going to drop out because they're not viable in that environment. But the very large, high-endurance ones that can stand off, the sensors are powerful enough to stand off. And then also something that's coming down the road is very small UAV things that are persistent that can do some of these missions that will remain relevant. But LEO is just not, I think, going to be a huge factor in the U.S. approach to dealing with this A2AD challenge. So if you can see where this is going, and it's where we went already in the mid to late 80s, which is it really might be the U.S. that becomes the big threat to this kind of view of civility in space, or at least in low Earth orbit, where the ASAT option is most evident right now. And I think that it actually could get worse before it gets better, because there's a lot of ways in which once we invest in this persistent airborne surveillance, I think we're going to discover a lot of other things that we can do with it that will continue to sort of reduce our dependence upon space, in this case of all types. And here I'm talking about communications. You know, we have a massive latent vulnerability in terms of we've become completely dependent upon commercial wideband satellites. Satellites that are designed to provide a high data rate signal and that have actually no jam resistance built in whatsoever. That's how we basically operate our predators, right, using those kind of satellites. They can be shut down in an instant by anyone that has any kind of electronic warfare capability. The fundamental way to deal with that problem is not to stay in space. It's to do airborne relays. And you know, we've already done this on some level for other reasons. I don't know how many of you remember or know Bert Rutan, who you know, the famous aircraft designer, who's done all sorts of interesting things with airplanes. One of his ideas back in the days when all those low Earth orbit internet providers like Teledesic were crashing and burning, he came up with this idea of just parking airplanes at 60,000 feet over urban areas. And I mean, that's the best satellite in the world, right? As long as it can survive. And see, the interesting thing about the A2AD problem is that we own the air where the problem is, right? It's not like being over land. It's not like being over the heart of a hostile country in the middle of their air defenses. We own the airspace. So in terms of the dependence on communication satellites, which are physically probably survivable up in geosynchronous orbit, I think we're going to discover that persistent airborne approaches to the problem are also going to help address that. So in that sense, I think the problem gets worse, because our self-deterrence, you know, from maybe trying to do something about this problem that poses a significant threat to our carriers, you know, may get worse before it gets better, if it gets better at all. And I suppose I'll stop there. Great. Okay.
Well, I'd like to try and kind of summarize some of the main themes that have been talked about by the previous three speakers, and pull it back a bit to ask, so what? You know, what does this mean for the big picture? And in particular, you know, we've seen through the other three presentations that China is investing significantly in space capabilities, and in particular space-based ISR capabilities. And these capabilities do play a major role in their strategy for both national security, as well as becoming a regional power, and at a more tactical level in their A2AT strategy for, you know, maritime and, of course, Taiwan Straits. And this represents a major shift from what they are now towards more of a space power and a spacefaring state, and a future where potentially they have much to lose in space. And so the question is, what impact might this shift have on their approach to various space security initiatives, in particular their you know, relationship with the United States? From the U.S. perspective, we habitually see China as a threat to U.S. space capabilities. But the flip side is also true from the Chinese perspective. You know, as was discussed, their approach to their space development space capabilities is very similar to how we developed our space capabilities and how the Russians developed theirs.
relatively small number of platforms, for each providing specific capability, little to no surge capability to replace lost assets, and these satellites the Chinese are building are vulnerable to the same things that the American satellites and the Russian satellites are largely vulnerable to. And that would primarily be hit-to-kill kinetic interceptors, dazzling, jamming, blinding, and a variety of other techniques that are not, you know, permanent kills. And while China is developing their anti-satellite technologies, as demonstrated by both the 2007 and 2010 ASAT test, the U.S. is also developing capabilities that could be used for ASAT. And so you have, you know, the U.S. is tested an Aegis air, seaborne system against a satellite, demonstrated a capability, and in the process of deploying those same capabilities throughout the Pacific theater as part of our missile defense strategy, and in the future upgrading those capabilities to potentially be able to intercept missiles and other things at much higher altitudes than what we've seen with Burnt Frost. And so, you know, from the Chinese perspective, even though the U.S. has said that that was a one-time thing, just like we have no way of verifying China's capabilities or intentions, and thus must look after what capabilities might they possess and how it might be we counter those, same thing goes true for China. You know, they're not going to, from looking at from their own national security picture, they're not going to be able to say, well, the U.S. says they're not going to use this to attack satellites, so therefore we don't have to worry about it. They are going to be concerned about it. And so, as China develops its space capabilities, the strategic picture between the U.S.-China relationship is not quite the asymmetric actor with nothing to lose against the space power that has everything to lose that is commonly brought up in discussions. Certainly at this moment in time, the U.S. and China are not peer competitors in space. But over the next several years and the next decade or more, China is going to move towards becoming more of a peer with U.S. and space capabilities. And so how is that going to change the relationship? There are currently three major initiatives going on within the international security realm on the context of space security. And so I also would like to talk a bit about how this perhaps changing perspective in China might impact those. And those three are the United Nations Committee on the Peace Leases of Outer Space has recently started up an agenda item entitled the Long-Term Sustainability of Space Activities. And they've created four expert working groups that are looking at things such as space debris mitigation, space debris, national implementation mitigation guidelines, space situation awareness data sharing, safe space operations, space weather, regulations and guidance for new actors. And this reflects an emerging trend among many of the space powers to think of space in terms of an environment that needs to be protected to ensure that we can continue to use it in the foreseeable future. It's in somewhat response to the threats of space debris and space weather and radio frequency interference and those things that have cropped up and become quite an issue. The second initiative is the European proposed International Space Code of Conduct, which is a proposal by the European Union to create an agreement, non-binding, to establish basic norms of behavior to enhance the safety, stability, security, and sustainability of space. It is proposed by the EU, but the goal is that it would be open to all states and it would be an international initiative. Over the last year, the EU has been gathering input and comments from many states. Word is they are currently redrafting it, and the goal would be over the next 6 months, maybe a bit longer, to hold some regional dialogues on the code, to gather more input, and then convene a expert group to revise the draft and open it for signature. The third initiative is the UN Group of Governmental Experts, or GGE. GGEs are not new. They periodically crop up within the UN system. This one was proposed and primarily by Russia within the UN First Committee, and the idea would be to create a group of governmental experts, approximately 15, that would propose, make recommendations on outer space transparency and confidence building measures back to the First Committee. And so in looking at China's approach to these three initiatives, the question becomes, do they share the same perspective on the space domain as the others, as Europe, as the United States, as Russia, that are promoting these? And I think the answer is, for the moment, not necessarily. Because China's engagement with these three initiatives and others has been mixed. In some areas they've been supportive, in some areas they've not. So for example, with the Copious Group on long-term sustainability of space, the Chinese delegation in Copious has been very supportive and active in the discussions. And they are playing a helpful role within that environment. But I would not say that that is reflective of all of China, and there probably is multiple views on this. I mean, it's the foreign ministry that is involved in Copious and not the PLA. And I would be curious to see whether or not the PLA even knows there is something called long-term sustainability of space. And from their publications on doctrine and policy that we talked about earlier, my take on it is that the Chinese national security community is looking at space in very much the same way the U.S. military did 10, 15 years ago, with the Space Vision 2020, and space is the ultimate high ground, and the U.S. needs to control and dominate space in order to, you know, play a key role in national security goals. We have shifted from that, in part because the vulnerabilities of that strategy have been exposed by things like the 2007 ASAT test and other recent developments in space. But I'm not quite sure that China has caught up to that. In some way, their thinking and their perspective on the space domain is lagging. And I would say this is not unique to China. This is something we're seeing in all of the emerging space powers. India, Brazil, and others, they all are, as they're moving from mostly civil, scientific, socioeconomic benefit uses of space to more of a national security, military uses of space, they're moving along the same path, in some cases, the U.S. and Russia did, but they're lagging. My personal experience, in October, we held a workshop in Beijing in partnership with Beihang University and a couple others on space sustainability. And the idea was that there are all these discussions going on in U.S. and Europe on some of these topics like space debris and space situations, data sharing, and space weather, but in many cases the Chinese are absent. So we, for the second year in a row, have done a workshop in China that brings together people from industry and academia and some other members of the Chinese space collective to get them more aware of these topics and kind of gauge what their perception is. And what we learned was that they're very interested in them, but they're very new topics. Space debris mitigation is an emerging topic in China, and they are working on national regulations to implement debris mitigation guidelines, but it is not at the level of development it's still lagging what's going up in the U.S. and Russia and particular Europe. Within the in context of the GGE and the Code of Conduct, China has been very much less supportive. In 2008, Russia and China jointly proposed a treaty to the Conference on Disarmament on the prevention of the placement of weapons in outer space. And since then, China has insisted that that is the option on the table for discussion, and everything else is very much a distraction from that treaty. Russia has recently softened that position, which we demonstrated through their backing of the GGE, China is still very much saying we should be talking about the PPWT, but very recently has softened it somewhat, saying, well, we can discuss supplemental measures such as the potential GGE or the Code of Conduct. But even within the Code of Conduct, they have provided feedback to the Europeans, and their comments were along the lines of strip out all the space debris stuff and strip out all the notification measures, which are generally not very helpful to the process. So some recommendations perhaps for the future. Certainly this discussion on sustainability, norms of behavior, and space security in general, it needs to include China as an active participant. They own 30% of the space debris. They're launching as many new satellites as anybody else, and they are becoming a space power. And historically, we've not done a great job of including those conversations. One case in point is there's been a significant discussion within the U.S. and Europe recently on active removal of debris objects. In 2009, just out here in Virginia, DARPA and NASA held a conference on this topic. Shortly thereafter, there was one in Moscow in April 2010, and then in June 2010, CNES held one in Paris. China was not present at any of those three meetings. And I think that is important, because if they, you know, if they're absent from the discussion, and there are some significant dual use and transparency questions with an activity such as active removal, that could pose some problems. And as was hinted at a couple of times here, I think you're starting to see some similarities potentially between the U.S.-China strategic relationship and the U.S.-Soviet Union or U.S.-Russia strategic relationship, in that, you know, as China moves more towards more of a space power and more of a peer in space, how does that change the relationship? Both sides might end up relying on space. Both sides have something to lose. And as we learned with the Soviets and the Russians, it is possible to have dialogue with an adversary, and you do get good things from such a dialogue. You build familiarity, but you can also collect some nice intelligence. There are three major challenges I'd like to mention briefly in closing with all this. One is not to underestimate the lag between China's perspective and that of other emerging space powers on what the space domain, what the important things are, and the rest of the space-faring states. I think that is an important thing whenever we come to discussing a topic. If the U.S. and Europe don't share the same goals as China and India and Brazil and others, then it's very difficult to build consensus and get constructive dialogue. China and many other emerging space powers lack a cohesive interagency whole-of-government approach to forming policy on many topics, but in particularly space. You know, in the U.S., we do have this burdensome interagency process, but it takes into account perspective from many different actors in the U.S. government and also industry on forming policy issues. There are very few other countries that have that sort of a process. And so you may have China's foreign ministry out talking about something regarding space, but that may not be reflective of the whole of Chinese government. You may have the PLA out talking about something, giving a speech on space, and that may not be reflective of what foreign ministry thinks. And finally, I would just say that it's politically easier for both sides to demonize the other to bolster national support than it is for them to work together constructively. And that is just a function of the politics that needs to be worked through. And with that, I'll conclude and open up for Q&A.
Okay. Thank you. That was really just a fascinating panel. I'm sure there's a lot of food for thought in it. I would ask that you would, when I call on you, that you wait for the microphone, and that if you could please identify yourself and your affiliation, appreciate it. Turn it off that question back.
Joe Felton, the guest I have on the learning today is the president of the International Space Safety Foundation. I'd like Brian to comment a little bit further about the they that we keep hearing about, that's China, and the diversity that is China. When we met at the International Space University in Beihai University, we were the associate dean, but we couldn't get through a gate because the Army official there wouldn't let us through. There is, I think, the China of North China and South China, the commercial Hong Kong and Shanghai that sees the world much different than maybe the people in Beijing, the foreign ministry versus the PLA, and so on. And I think that also you have the sort of the commercial people who are looking at space, the systems in Nigeria and Venezuela and so on, looking at commercial markets and space in that way, and then the military looking. So if you could comment about the diversity that actually exists, and I think they doesn't help us get much insight.
I would agree with that comment. I will comment a little bit on that, but I would also open up to the others. I know Mark probably knows a bit more about the specifics of the multiple days within China. I completely agree, and we've seen this through our dealings with China. Secure World, we primarily have had a relationship with the Chinese Academy of Sciences and with Beihang University and a couple of the universities, and even then there's not a lot of crosstalk there. I would add another issue, and that is the issue of disciplinary silos. Here in the U.S., there is quite a bit of churn between the engineering, policy, law fields, or at least we interact on a regular basis. And there is some cross-pollination between those different disciplines. My experiences in China and other places, that is not happening there. It's very much silos of engineering and technical people and policy people and foreign relations people and lawyers. And they rarely ever interact, let alone have cross-educational opportunities. And so to your point about there being multiple days in China in terms of governmental entities, whether it's the civil service, whether it's the PLA, whether it's the party, I would also add there are multiple days in terms of disciplinary groups. And just because you have involvement with engineers within China does not necessarily mean they understand any of the technical, or sorry, any of the political or legal issues.
Can I just follow up? There's some thought or expression that when the weather satellite was shot down, that this was a PLA act and it really wasn't coordinated through the government. Would you comment on that?
The true experts on that would probably be Greg Kulaki and Jeffrey Lewis. I know they published some things on it. In reading their published materials, it appears it was coordinated through the Politburo, but I believe Dean Chen made the comment that at the time the foreign minister was not actually sitting on the Politburo. And so that might be some indication of why the foreign ministry appeared to be completely in the dark and unaware and the delayed response. I think that is probably an example of this lack of a whole of government or a silo approach to their thinking.
So on the issue of diversity within government on space issues, that's a valid point. They seem to be in a similar state that the United States was, for example, maybe back in the 50s or 60s in some ways. For example, they don't really have a NASA equivalent. The closest they would come would probably be something called the China National Space Administration, or CNSA, that at least started out to be sort of basically a keeper of international contracts and programs within the defense industry. There appears to be some indication that they've moved into the realm of program management. It's not quite yet there yet in terms of one particular program, which would be some of the moon exploration programs. But the one reason why I like to focus on organization is just the effect that organizational or bureaucratic competition has within their space program, even within the military itself. The Air Force, again, go back to the analogy of where the U.S. Air Force was in the 1950s, 1960s, the concept of aerospace power, or in Chinese they call it air and space integration, where it's a buzz term where air and space integration is the one single domain and need to have one organization in charge of both air and space, the aerospace, which of course is the same thing the U.S. Air Force did quite a while ago, the concept of aerospace, that having that sort of the domain of the air domain and being able to sort of stretch it out to space gives you some authority over space assets. But But within, and of course, within the industry, the R&D and industry, there's going to be natural, because they're one of the models that their space industry appears to have is U.S. space industry, you know, the Lockheed Martin sort of thing. So you're going to have competition and advocacies within individual academies for their program. So you have that dynamic as well. So, but in terms of it, there at one time it was an overall. What they call it, expert, a leading group, a state council, a leading group on space issues, but whether or not that exists today isn't clear, but that's a valid point. Very quick on the ASAT issue, of course, that supposedly the one that hit was the third in a series. There's so many tests that go on out of these different locations and such schedule, whether or not it was the, whether or not exactly what test this was this a design finalization or something like a critical design test? Was this something that industry drove, and then they contract out with the General Armaments Department, or was it something that GAD, the PLA drove, and that didn't coordinate? That's, to me, it's within this sort of bureaucratic structure. It's easy to see why it would not have been coordinated fully, particularly given the number of tests that go on. The number of missile tests that go on is just incredible. Anyway, back over to you.
Sure. The Chinese also bemoan the many actors that play a role in China's space enterprise. So you see that their writings on the 2008 Wenchuan earthquake, they said that one of the issues with bringing space to the rescue efforts was that there are just too many organizations playing a role, and so there was no one coordinating body there that they could go to and say, okay, you know, where do we get the satellite data? You know, where do we get the communications capability? So, you know, that took a while to set up. So there's nothing, it didn't, from their comments, it seems that there's not, you know, it's a difficult thing to get to. So, and following up on what Mark was saying about the Air Force, so you have organizations like the Air Force saying, see, we have this problem. There are too many organizations involved with space, and there's no head. And the Air Force actually is probably the ideal service to take over the space enterprise. And so what you have then is, you know, the bureaucratic fighting then about, you know, which service should actually control space assets.
Jim and then Tiffany.
Why do you think that is? Is it because people don't know who to talk to because of the stovepiping issue? And if that's the case, or is it something else, who should be responsible for figuring out who to invite and how to get them there?
Good question. I don't have the answer, but I probably have some clues. For example, in the case of the DARPA-NASA debris removal conference here, it was organized by DARPA, which is a government, you know, a DOD entity, and for them to, unfortunately, the way they did it, well, they were required to pre-screen and clear everybody that was attending the conference, and so that presents a hurdle for anybody, a Chinese national, to come and to attend. Not to mention, they also have to get a visa to come to the U.S. in order to be able to attend the conference if they're not already here. You see that a lot with events organized in the United States. It's not only the travel times and the cost, but obtaining a visa in time to attend the conference crops up over and over again as a hurdle. And then, you know, the issues of if a U.S. government entity, particularly a DOD entity, is organizing something, that presents some additional security challenges. As far as the others, I think, you know, Europe, they were very focused on Europe. I was one of the only few Americans that were there. So it wasn't that they deliberately excluded China, but it wasn't in their sight picture. I think that's instructive as well.
Jim.
Thanks, Jim Wolf, Reuters. I wanted to get the panel's views of the news contained in a draft report by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. It said that an Air Force briefing specified that at least two U.S. Climate monitoring and terrain mapping satellites have been interfered with in, I think, 2007, 2008, and it laid it at the door of the Chinese military as the most likely suspect. I wonder if any of you have any more insight into those reported incidents, and whether you also have come to the conclusion, any such conclusion, that the Chinese would have been involved, were most likely involved, and what is the significance of it in terms of what you're talking about?
Let's take a crack at that one first.
I'll make a couple of comments, and I'll leave it open to others. I have not seen. I don't think the report's published yet, and if it hasn't, I have not seen it yet. I think that the claim was that somebody gained access, full command and control access to these two satellites. I did not see the claim that they were actually disrupted or interfered with, interfered with their mission in any way, but it was more of an access claim. I would make two points. One is that it apparently came through Svalbard, which is a very, very heavily used ground station for polar orbiting satellites. And so there are a lot of people using it, a lot of people that have access to it. So the potential people that, you know, could have been doing it is probably a fairly long list. The second thing I would say is that they're fairly old satellites. I believe they were launched in 1999, which means they're probably designed in the 10 years before that. And I question, I don't know specifics, but I would wonder whether or not they were even designed with cybersecurity and encryption protocols even in mind. So as far as the challenge in getting access to such command and control, I'm not even sure how difficult that would be.
Anything else?
I'm not aware of it. I haven't looked at it.
I'd just say real briefly, it shouldn't be difficult at all if it's not built in a very robust way to start with. And for that kind of satellite, it probably wouldn't be. But I'll give you another example of something that just happened recently, and I'll try and relatively recently, I'll try and keep it short to give you an idea of how easy this can be, which is that we, after the late 2003, early 2004, sometime in there, the Voice of America wanted to set up a high-frequency broadcast into Iran to do convince the Iranians of the wonders of our civilization. And the means by which they chose to do that are fairly traditional, which is to broadcast the signal via satellite to the HF transmitter that they'd set up in Iraq. And the way the satellites they chose were the ones I was talking about before, include the ones that, you know, in many cases we do lots of really sensitive stuff with, and the Iranians jammed the signal from Cuba and shut it down. And, of course, we just sent it by fiber cable across the ocean and solved the problem that way, so they're still hearing about the superiority of our civilization. But it wasn't hard for them to shut that signal down when it was going by a commercial satellite. Hmm.
Okay. Question in the front?
Should I wait?
Yeah, could you please?
Frank DiMantino, Integrity Applications. I wanted to return to the previous line of questioning. If you look back, even the way we treated international diplomacy, and I think in the military, I would make the contention that we treat space as special, you know, a special venue, the 1967 Space Treaty, different things that we do. And Mark, you had mentioned that, you know, the Chinese do a lot of missile tests and do a lot of different things. I find it odd that I think this is an exemplar that shows that they don't treat space as special, you know, as a different venue. It's interesting, too, that as China rises, they want to play as a big boy, you know, they want to be a big player, but they continually screw up. You know, the EP3 incident, because they don't have a National Security Council, is an example of that. The ASAT test, where they didn't really think through the duplicity of the debris, and their points in the UN. I'd love to get everyone's comment on this. So, and I think the United States may have faced this a little bit too with the Russians in the way that we thought about nuclear weapons versus the way the Soviet Union thought about nuclear weapons as just a bigger bomb versus, you know, something special. So how do we're kind of compromised by this idea that we think space is special. How do we get past that, or how do we evangelize that to the rest of the world so that, you know, space security can be more sustainable, more, you know, more tractable, I guess.
Let me sort of focus on that space debris issue. In 2005, there was a major initiative launched within in China, led by the China Academy of Sciences, to be able to on the space debris mitigation issue. They've actually tracked space debris. Matter of fact, I went to one site in 1992, a long time ago, where they track and they catalog space debris. Thousands of objects that are out there, and so they've been aware of the space debris issue. Significant investment in sort of prioritizing the mitigation, the space debris mitigation issue in 2005. A center set up for space debris mitigation, and again, this Nanjing Purple Mountain Observatory under the China Academy of Sciences. And that was 2005. And then being aware, at least with this in this one sliver of the governmental structure, being aware of the issue of space debris, and then suddenly having basically blowing a weather satellite to smithereens in space. I don't know how many objects that created, but certainly didn't help things. You just have to wonder sometimes if they're their own worst enemy, because one side is aware of some of the problems, the political problems that they would create. For example, MOFA, they're the ones who have to sort of take all the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has to take all the political heat. And just sometimes wonder if they're their own worst enemy sometimes just by not coordinating amongst themselves. So it's an issue that getting a good handle on who's responsible for what, and even bringing them into international dialogues, who you go to is going to be important. For example, if you go to the wrong agency for your initial sort of proposal on something, some of these guys may not get along. And if they go out and whenever you should have gone to another organization, it's for them being the lead. For example, space debris, the organization to go to, I would imagine, would be Academy of Sciences, and let them sort of, if they want to participate, be the advocacy for it within the broader government. But if you go to other guys, they could, it just may not happen because it would get stuck down in bureaucratic, just organizational problems, political differences, personalities, just that whole thing. But,
I guess I would argue that the Chinese do consider space as special and important. I think you have to just look back at what is the September launch of the Tiangong 1, their space station, which was still is unmanned. But if you looked at who showed up for the launching, it was the who's who of the Chinese leadership. I think all of maybe except one member of the Politburo. Attended the launch either in Beijing or at Jiuquan. All of the CMC members, with the exception one, the commander of the Air Force, which is very interesting, showed up in one form of another, either in Beijing or at Jiuquan. And so, you know, this involved no astronauts yet. Hu Jintao was there, was in Beijing. Wen Jiabao, the premier, was at Jiuquan. The next in line, Xi Jinping, was in Beijing. So there's very high level support for the space program. And also, you know, going back to the writings that I'm reading is, there is a great deal of emphasis placed on space in military operations. Also, in society, generally about how space can improve China's comprehensive national power. And you see, often you see arguments about how space can help out China politically, economically, technologically, and militarily.
I would just add a question and one brief point. The question would be how much of their approach to space is a function of them studying us, and how much of it is driven by their own perspectives. So in other words, if we see space as special in our doctrine and our approach to it, and they're reading our doctrine and looking at how we developed and learning from that, is that going to, does that drive them to view it in the same way eventually? I think that's an open question. The other comment I would make is you started talking about, international engagement. I would also just point out that it also depends on who in the U.S. is doing the international engagement. For example, STRATCOM is the lead for a lot of the space situation awareness data sharing efforts and cooperative efforts. And that sends signals, whether or not we intend to or not, that the same entity that controls our nuclear weapons also is being our lead for international cooperation on SSA, and within China the PLA controls SSA, so you now have two entities, STRATCOM and the PLA, that don't necessarily get along the best of friends, and they're also the ones that have to get along in order to have cooperation on this particular issue. So I would throw that into the mix as well.
I'm Mark Render. I'm executive director of the GOI Foundation. GOI is a satellite imagery company that owns high-resolution Earth imaging systems. And in about 14 months, they're going to launch a commercial imaging system with a ground resolution of 13 inches. Is there any, under current U.S. policy, however, the company is required to fuzz up or degrade the imagery to half-meter ground resolution before making it for sale publicly? But at high resolutions, what is the status of China's, maybe Mark knows this because you mentioned, quarter-meter resolution of some of their potentially future systems. What are their resolutions of their current civil Earth observation systems, and what could be planned for civil commercial systems?
I don't think we. Some of the public briefing I've seen 2 meters maybe in terms of electro-optical. I've seen references to 2 meters or something like that. For some of the commercial systems, not much better than that. But I don't have a good handle on what their current, like for example, the CBRS, the China Brazil Earth Resource Demo.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of that, that one, I'm not. I think it's 2 meters, but I could be wrong. It could be better. But on that 0.25 meter resolution goal, that was appeared to be sort of somewhat of an aspirational goal by one of the designers within the China Academy of Space Technology. On the licensing issue, the other part about licensing issue or export, trying to let somebody else address that part.
I know that the CBRS was, I think, 3 meters way back when, and that the Chinese, I believe, I'd have to go back and check, but I think they were shooting for a goal of 1 meter, but where they actually are right now is difficult to tell.
Expert control.
But I would say on the export control issue that China is wanting to become a major space power. Its space industry has the goal by 2015 to becoming a major aerospace industry on along the lines of Boeing, Lockheed Martin, EADS. And China is taking a stronger approach to the commercialization of their space program. And so I would not be surprised if China were to get more into the commercial imagery field. You see that with their Huanjing satellites, which I think have, 30-meter resolution, something like that. It's not that the Yaogan satellite is their higher end, which they don't publicize the resolution. The Huanjing has a 30-meter resolution, and they've been very proactive with loaning those capabilities out for disaster mitigation. So I think when Australia had its forest fires, they were helping the Australians out with imagery. And but you could see where that capability could, where they could start selling that capability at some point in the future.
Hi, it's Edmond Christ, the space attaché at the Embassy of France. Is there any initiative to invite China to cooperate on space exploration as it has been done between the US and Russia? Could improve dialogues about other issues. So, is there any topic on that?
I would say that there is some, that has certainly been discussed, but there's currently legal restrictions that prevent NASA from doing that. There's specific language in the most recent Authorization Act that prevents NASA from spending any money on cooperation with China, even discussing it. So, for the moment, until that changes, I don't think it's going to happen. There is the debate over whether or not such cooperation falls into the realm of foreign policy or not. And thus, is it actually under Congress's purview to limit that? Because foreign policy is still seen under the Constitution as the, under the sole direction of the President. That is a debate currently going on.
But China is very open to international cooperation. You see that they are part of the Asia Pacific Space Cooperation Organization, which is based in Beijing, and so they are sort of the de facto head of that. They have what appears to be extensive cooperation with the Ukraine. They participated with Brazil on satellites. Even the Tiangong, or actually the Shenzhou 8 that was just launched, has some experiments with Germany. And for the TTNC system for tracking the Tiangong, they've set up stations with Brazil and France, and then recently with Australia, which I thought was very interesting. So the Chinese on their part are very interested in international cooperation.
I guess I actually would like to build off on that. Let's say export control was not a concern. Theoretically, it could be possible.
Would
the Chinese be interested in cooperating with the United States specifically on space, or has that ship sailed, in a manner of speaking?
In terms of, I guess, sort of defining what space cooperation would be, there's this, for example, the NASA sort of things, cooperating on a manhunt, for example, on a space station or some aspect of space exploration. There's also the issue, it's not necessarily cooperation, but it's a business issue. Which is, for example, the sale of U.S. satellites to customers within China, or the contracting for use of contracting for launch of satellites for any customer, whether it's U.S. or international use of Chinese launch vehicles, which was a major part of the space cooperation effort back in the late 80s all the way up to about 95, 96 time frame, that went by the wayside after a few satellite mishaps and lapses in the technology security control program that went on. But if export control on that issue of exports of satellites or use of Chinese launch vehicles, one question: is there even a market in China for U.S. satellites anymore, or have they surpassed what we could provide commercially in terms of what they've been doing with their particularly military satellites? There was two military communication satellites they already developed and launched. But on the I would imagine that they. There's a certain amount of status. There's not just a certain amount. There's a significant degree of prestige and status that comes into play whenever you're dealing with the big boys in space on the international front. So there's a significant degree of prestige that would come along with that, which I think is a source of the legislative restrictions on NASA by within the House of Representatives. Having to do with, the debate that goes in is do you reward a spacefaring nation basically using that leverage of space to be able to at least make a statement about, for example, human rights records and things like this. Whether or not space warrants that, or whether you can target something else, you can also start a nil-to-nil relationship. So you can target a number of things to be able to sort of make a point. But I think in general, on the political front, I think China would love to be able to cooperate on in certain areas that may or may not have much of a technology aspect, but certainly from a political perspective, it gives them sort of a seat, a place at the mat, or a seat at the table in terms of on the international front and the prestige front. Mm-hmm.
An article in China Space News, which is the official newspaper of China's space industry, stated after the Tiangong launch that one benefit of successfully launching and operating a space station was that it would make China a better partner for participation in the International Space Station, which I thought was an interesting take on it. So it seems that at least some elements of China's space enterprise are would be open to cooperation with the United States. And if there weren't export control laws, of course, I think China would be very much open to all sorts of technical cooperation. You see it already happening with Ukraine, Russia. Even in the commercial sphere, you see all sorts of joint ventures being started in China. If you look at even Airbus in the aerospace realm, there's lots of cooperation with the China C919 airliner. There's a large number of countries and companies that are participating with China on that program. So, I could see that China would be open to lots of technical cooperation if they were allowed.
I would add a caveat, and that's to reiterate a point made by, I think, both Dean Chang and Greg Kulaki, is that part of it depends upon how the cooperation is pitched. If it's pitched as, oh, we'd like to help you, it's come across very badly. They're very proud of their space capabilities. They're very proud of what they've accomplished, and that they want to be approached as an equal partner and not as someone that needs help from the United States to accomplish their goals. And I think that would play a major role in any particular cooperation.
Anything to add, Owen?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. I hate to do this because there's obviously still a lot of interest, but we have been told we need to get out of the room fairly quickly. So I would thank you all for being here. Please join me in thanking our panel for a fascinating discussion. Our website for anyone who was unable to attend, and for the love of God, please grab a sandwich on the way out. Thank you again.